Wow.
I am. We're going to call the meeting to order. I know. I have strong right hand, apparently. So first we want to apologize for starting a little late. The last committee ran long and took us a while to set up. So thank you all for being here. I want to remind everyone that we are going to limit testimony to 3 minutes, and we're going to be a little firmer than yesterday, letting you know when your 3 minutes is up. Or closer to 2 minutes if you can do it. I've been directed. And members, if we can limit questions as best you can. If there's something burning, we do want to get it answered, but we want to try to get through. As you can see, we left yesterday with maybe 8 or 9 names on the list, and it's grown, and apparently you only have page 1 of 2 pages of testifiers. So we are going to have to keep moving. And so with that, I'm going to ask everybody to come to order, and we will ask our first testifier, Steve Larson, and Kurt Rutzen from the Arc of Minnesota. And if you'd
enter. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Steve Larson with the Arc Minnesota, and Kurt Rutzen and I will be testifying together. And we represent people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. There are some great things in the governor's budget, and we want to point a few of those out and then share a few concerns that we have. Under Reform 2020, there's going to be a substantial change in the way PCA services are provided, and it will become known as Community First Services and Supports. And so we need to do a lot of work during this legislative session to make that transition. And this will impact 20,000 people as we move to a self-directed model in which people will have more control over the budgets that they get and will be able to purchase things such as modifications that will help them remain in their homes. Another item in Reform 2020 that we'd like to applaud is the $12 million in additional funding to help children with autism. The ARC Greater Twin Cities shared with me recently they provide advocacy for children and adults, and two-thirds of the people that they provide advocacy for are individuals with autism. And so the 1 in 88 figure seems to be very accurate as far as those types of situations. Another area that hasn't been talked about in testimony so far is waiver management improvements. We believe that we need to maximize the resources that are available out there, and that counties and the state need to work much more closely together so that individuals that need services can find them when they need them. So we applaud moving towards that. We also have a moratorium in place, and that has caused some hardships, particularly with individuals with significant behaviors, that type of thing. And so we think there needs to be work in not only managing the waiver programs that would help with the moratorium, but also some special exceptions process so that we could meet the high needs of individuals with disabilities. In a minute, I'm going to turn it over to Kurt Rutzen to talk about quality assurance, and the state has made a major and significant investment in trying to improve quality, but we have some ideas on how to even improve that particular proposal. And I just want to wrap up by saying that in the past 10 years, hundreds of millions of dollars have been cut from our programs. In fact, this year, in the budget, or from past legislation, it even gets worse. Under current law, our programs will have a 1.67% reduction for 6 months, starting on July 1st to December 31st. These cuts have meant long waiting lists for our waiver programs, no increases in wages for direct support professionals, and limits on the number of days that some individuals are able to attend their day training and habilitation programs. There is plenty of talk at the Capitol about restoring the school shift, as there should be, but there has been little talk at the Capitol about the disability shift. And this includes higher parental fees, long waiting lists, no increases for staff, individuals sitting in institutions when they could be living in the communities. So we want to work with you together to address that. That item, 1.67%, is $16 million. And so we're willing to work with you to see if we can find that within the budget. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Kurt.
Morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you so much for having me. Today, the voices of persons with disabilities are not being heard. I think we can all agree to this is going on after seeing lots of cuts in the past.
Thank you.
there were too many, many cuts in the past. I won't go through them all, or would be here all day. And I also respect everyone in this room and their time. And I thank you so much. Okay. This should not be the cuts in the past. It should not be. This is not too about myself. You see, I do pretty good. I got lots and lots of friends and family who love me so much. And you all probably read my magazine. Maybe you put it on your dartboard, too. It's a good picture for that. My faith, family, and friends are so important to me. But to get me to this place, like everyone, it took funding and it took programs. I just didn't wake up. And here I was. It took funding, you guys, and it took programs. I hope you hear me this morning. If we cut these programs and funds, where will we be as a whole? As quality, quality, quality in the person. Well, it's 2013. Are we going to move forward on this whole thing, or are we going to go backwards? We choose. We decide as a whole. What are we going to do? We want to work with you to find funding for some regional councils. We need regional councils to do the quality. We want to thank the governor for funding several new quality incentives. Finally, I'm ready to work. Let's all pitch in. Let's all work together. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Both of you kept to the 3 minutes quite well. I appreciate that. You're good role models for those to follow. And, Kurt, I do have your picture right on the table in my office. I see it every day.
Thank you. You're too kind.
Thank you so much. We do have a quorum. And so, so I'm going to formally call the meeting to order. And I don't know if anyone has spent a moment reading the minutes. Do we have any out?
So moved.
Representative Moran moves the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? We've passed the minutes. Next up, we have Jessica Webster. Thank you. If you'd read your name into the...
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, and I'm here to speak just to 2 points, and they relate to children and family services, and specifically the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And so we're in partial support of the governor's budget. We think there are good investments made, but there are two things that we would prioritize in lieu of what the governor has funded in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. One is repealing the family cap. Some of you have heard that referred to as the newborn penalty. For about 10 years now, we've been denying assistance to babies, low-income children born to very poor mothers. And right now, we cap about 50 children a month from receiving assistance. It's really bad policy. We know that there are time limits in this program, so we're basically denying assistance to children for when they're born till the time they're about 2 or 3 years old. And so we really hope that this can be funded in lieu of one of the provisions in the governor's budget. The second that you heard about at length yesterday that I will not cover at length today is just raising the cash grant. Right now, both of these provisions can be funded with existing federal TANF dollars. There are TANF dollars left over from last year. There are TANF dollars on the bottom line. So we're not asking for new revenue. At a minimum, within these federal TANF dollars, there is enough for a COLA to the cash grant. I think there are groups that want a lot more than that and think that that's not enough. But at a minimum, there is enough there for a COLA. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so very much. The next testifier is Ed Ide from Mental Health Association of Minnesota.
Morning, Madam Chair, members Morning. Of the committee. My name is Ed Ide. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. While overall this budget keeps money for mental health services, the revenue neutrality appears to take funding away from some services and moves it to other services, but we can't be sure because it is lacking some information. We need to keep strong local services in our communities. Counties and adult mental health initiatives may lose funding that provides services to local communities that help people stay well. We don't know that that is a good trade-off. Commissioner Jessen spoke about DHS having two buckets, the ACA and the rest of DHS. We support Minnesota engaging in the ACA. We support expansion of Minnesota Care, the groundbreaking innovation for people who fall through the cracks. Hopefully, the federal government will support this and we can provide health care to more Minnesotans. We like the expansion of school-linked mental health funding and the expansion of crisis teams. We like the expansion of community supports and housing. These services keep people out of institutions and in their homes. In Becker County in 2011, 75 people, it was suggested that they be committed. The crisis teams diverted 48 of those 75 people, so only 28 people were hospitalized out of the 75. Those crisis teams make a difference in your community where you live. While we have some issues with the Olmstead plan as it relates to people with mental illnesses, the fact of the matter is there is no choice about keeping people out of institutions and helping them live well in the community. It is the right thing to do, and it saves money. Some of you will recall a few years ago, DHS directed the state-operated services to move people out of AMRTC. We convened work groups and spent over 18 months determining what community services would look like. Currently, we have people in Anoka who have complex medical needs but do not need the medical necessity of care. This is costly and slows down the transition of others needing this level of care to obtain it. Now, in this budget is a plan for doing just that. We may be short on information at this time, and we may not all believe that state-operated services is the right provider for these services, but something is being proposed as a result of the legislature's direction. We need to make this plan work to better care for people, save money, and move forward with appropriate treatment for mental illnesses. I'm certain that we will be having more discussion in the next couple of months as more specific options are included. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And next is Melinda Hugdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. I think the 2 days of this testimony shows how broad and wide the jurisdiction of this committee is and how many tough choices there are for everyone involved in putting the budget together in human services. So I just wanted to hit a few things. I wear a few different hats within Legal Aid, as many of you know. So I'm going to talk about child care and licensing and some of the child permanency provisions in less than hopefully 3 minutes. I think everybody in this room cares a lot about kids. We want them to do well. We want good outcomes, especially for the kids who are the most vulnerable. And as we kind of look at these pieces, particularly about the child care and the licensing, but it also fits in the child permanency, we all want safety, and we've all talked a lot, and we all want school readiness, but really our push is also that that has to ride along with access. And access is really the key, because if kids that we're trying to reach with these good programs we're working on are not in child care, then they're not the beneficiaries of all of these good ideas that we're trying to make available for them. Child care assistance, which I'm sure you'll all be talking about in much more detail as time goes on, is, we think, a very good program because it not only gives parents an opportunity to work and get themselves hopefully further off, maybe completely off of assistance, but it also gives that early education exposure and school readiness benefits that you guys, I'm sure, have all been hearing a lot about and we've been talking about, too. We are disappointed that there are no funds to reduce the basic sliding fee account directly. We have about 6,000 families on the waiting list, and, of course, the most direct way for access for families is to get them off the waiting list and get them into child care. That being said, there are some good things in the budget about in the child care area. One of them is the rate provider differential for child care assistance for rated parent aware programs. That will help with the access and school readiness balance because it will hopefully make sure that we have kids on child care assistance who are utilizing those slots in the highest parent aware rated programs, which I think is the goal we should be working toward. We want to make sure that that is happening. There are some licensing provisions that relate to infant mortality and some other things that I know a lot of other folks will be talking a lot in more detail. At Legal Aid, our issue in it is really access, and our request is this, is that we need providers. We need good providers, but we need access. And if provisions get too onerous and we start hearing that providers are going to close their doors or not take child care assistance kids, then we have parents who can't go to work. So that's our plea with that issue, is just to keep the access piece in mind. On the bigger picture of licensing, there's one provision we're looking forward to talking more with the department on. I just wanted to highlight it. There is a budget request for increased access to MNSIS, which is the court information system about arrest records. We look forward to talking with the department more. We haven't seen more language of what that's all about yet. So we, many of you know, our antenna go up when we hear about increased use of arrest records in this area. So we're going to be looking at that with the department. And finally, I know there was a fair amount of discussion yesterday about North Star, so I won't get into detail about that, but just wanted to highlight it, and we look forward to continuing to work with the department. We haven't seen the language yet, so we'll be looking at that too, but I think all of us want to make sure that our most vulnerable kids, that their needs are in fact being met, and we can get the best in outcomes possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. So next is Teresa Stark. Trisha?
Good morning. I'm Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Psychological Association, and I'm a licensed psychologist. I just have a couple of things. I'd like to support the investment in children's mental health and daycare in the governor's budget. These are sensible and effective responses to the recent tragedies. I'd also like to support the increase in medical assistance reimbursement for providers. For some of us, it's been at least 12 years since we've had an increase. Providing an increase will help to ensure that there are well-trained providers available for children and adults with mental health concerns. I'd also ask that you consider, as part of the increase, to extend reimbursement for consultation to primary care to other mental health professionals. Right now, only psychiatrists are paid for consultation. We give very different services. If we want to get serious about integrated care, we need to pay primary care and mental health professionals for taking the time to consult and coordinate care. Finally, lack of appropriate community housing with services is a huge bottleneck that increases costs and interferes with care for those most in need. Increasing funding in housing with services would have widespread benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next is Alice Hulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am a stakeholder, family member of the State Quality Assurance Council. I have a 28-year-old son who is in a group home, and so quality of services is vitally important to me. I want to thank the governor for putting funding in the budget to continue the work of the State Quality Council for another year. But an important component of what we're doing is to try to bring quality to the whole state of Minnesota, and without the funding for the regional councils, it's going to be very difficult for us to move forward in doing that. As the DHS and the state is moving towards changing how services are delivered with MIN choices and the new provider standards and the new ratepayer methodologies, the counties are going to lose their role that they have as the boots on the ground to to assure quality and standards throughout the whole state. And we were envisioning the quality regional councils as a way to bring that forward. The incidence of injuries and abuse are increasing every year. Between the biennium of 06 and 07 to 08 and 09, which are the most recent figures I have, abuse went from 864 cases to 2,216 cases. And serious injuries went from 2,500 to 3,074. So we do have a problem that indicates we need to work on quality. In our meetings, members from the licensing division have expressed concerns that as we go to less supervised settings, we could probably see an even greater increase in incidences of abuse and neglect and complaints. So I want to encourage everybody to look closely at the budget and help us find a way to bring these regional council pilots forward so that we can start getting a handle on these issues of abuse and neglect. Thank you.
Thank you. Diane Raff.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Diane Raff. I'm the director of the Living at Home Blockner's Programs, the statewide network, the Living at Home Network. And for over 30 years, our nonprofit, community-owned Living at Home Blockner's Programs have helped Minnesota's elders by creating solutions to the challenges of aging. Currently, we have 39 active, vibrant Living at Home Blockner's programs that provide cost-saving choices to older Minnesotans and their families in communities spread across the state, from Silver Bay to Wilmer, from Pine Island to Stephen. These valuable programs organize community resources to provide in-home social support and vital services such as coordinating care, providing volunteer visiting, grocery shopping, and transportation to medical appointments, and offering evidence-based health promotion programs, enabling seniors to remain living safely in their homes for extended periods of time, preserving their quality of life, and retaining their community networks, while at the same time avoiding the social and financial costs of nursing home placement. Now, for the past 20 years, the Minnesota legislature has recognized the great value of these uniquely Minnesota programs and has provided modest ongoing funding through the SALE projects to support up to 33 of our programs. In 2012, the state funding, with the help of over 2,000 volunteers, brought our vital services to 5,010 seniors, very frail seniors, in 31 communities, with an annual cost per senior of only $124, compared to the annual nursing home cost of over $44,000 for just one single medical assistance recipient. This funding is obviously, without question, a good investment. However, the level of funding has not increased during the past 20 years, in spite of the continued growth in need and the expansion of our Living at Home Blockner's programs and similar Faith in Action programs around the state. With an estimated 7 million adults reaching age 65 this next year, every state is looking for some way to control costs while meeting the needs of our growing aging population. And we in Minnesota are fortunate that Reform 2020 plan does include funding for core home and community-based services. And this will utilize the unique strengths of our community-based programs, like the Living at Home Blockner's programs, that utilize and use volunteers and community resources to deliver non-medical services intended to enable older adults to identify and manage their own risks, as well as help them stay living safe and affordable and appropriate lives in their own communities and in appropriate housing, and to continue actively participating in their communities. Now, here in Minnesota, we already have in place 60 of these community-based organizations that are ready and capable of growing to meet this need. With a small investment from the state, we can ensure that these These and new community-based programs will be able to thrive, grow, and continue to create uniquely local solutions to allow our citizens to age in their own communities, saving the taxpayers and individuals countless dollars. The Living at Home Block Nurse Program and our statewide organization, the Living at Home Network, is keenly aware of the great importance of these very small grants to our programs. Operating so cost-consciously, these community-based providers of core home and community-based services rely on this small but steady funding to leverage local resources and provide services that constantly evolve to meet the specific needs of the seniors in that community. We believe so strongly in the value of our programs and this model of community-based grassroots services for elders, the value that it brings to the individuals, and the strength and stability that it brings to our communities, as well as the money that it saves the state, that we know that now is the time for us to act and to open up our funding and to expand our funding so that this model can grow stronger and serve even more communities throughout Minnesota. And because of that, we're calling upon the legislature to simply fully fund that section of Reform 2020, the core home and community-based services, as it is written in the budget, so that now and in the future, we can provide these cost-saving measures and meet the needs, the growing needs of our seniors.
Thank you very much. Next is Mary Jo George.
Handout. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I do have a handout. In general, AARP is very supportive of many of the proposals in the governor's budget, but we also have some concerns we'd like to share with you today. First, let me begin by saying that we're supportive of the investments in nursing homes, along with the focus on many of the quality initiatives in long-term care, including home care. I know the governor had used or raised in his State of the State last night the AARP long-term care scorecard that shows that we are number one in the state, so we can be proud of that, but it also showed that we have major improvements to do in home care quality. That being said, we are very concerned with the cuts to the home and community-based services that are in this budget. Today, however, I want to shift gears a little bit and bring your attention to a different matter, and that is our ongoing concern with the eligibility changes to the Medicaid program. Many of you may know refer to them as the nursing home level of care changes that passed in 2009, and the loss of elderly waiver services for thousands of seniors living in the community beginning in 2014. As you may know, the elderly waiver program has been very successful in keeping people in their homes and out of more expensive nursing home placement. In particular, our major concern is around the potential for harm and the disruption of care as the department begins to transition these seniors into less robust and possibly inadequate programs. So we're really here today to ask lawmakers to work with us to mitigate some of the harm. Specifically, we have four concerns, and I will try to be brief. First is with the Essential Community Support Program. While the department sort of envisions this for individuals who are not yet eligible for Medicaid, for those seniors who are currently enrolled in the EW program, this is a significant cut to services. Second, we're very concerned with the potential loss of housing for seniors. This is because a senior who may have moved out of their home and into assisted living facility, neither of these transition programs pay for the 24-hour customized living service packages. And so we are concerned without adequate supports or transition planning, we may see seniors fall through the cracks and end up needing more costly nursing home care. Third, AARP is very concerned with that the seniors with high medical needs now will have to spend below poverty to retain Medicaid. And this is because we have different financial eligibilities between the program. And finally, for those seniors whose income is low enough to transfer to Medicaid, we do not believe that the Medicaid state plan benefits is a substitute for the elderly waiver program. So we have some concerns with that. In conclusion, we would be very interested in working with lawmakers to mitigate the harm, and I think it is interesting that the department is already doing this for seniors who are residing in nursing homes for 90 days or more, and we are worried about the continuing institutional bias of these programs. So we thank you and look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Representative Abel has a question.
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And I won't make the witness respond, but this is what they're talking about here is the stuff that was done in the DFL House and Senate under a Republican governor, ratified by a Republican House and Senate under a DFL governor. But there's a few gaps that we might want to revisit in that made sense at the time, but I think that's worth looking at this again. They'd keep a lot of the savings, but just make sure it's off lands people. It's one of the most bipartisan agreements ever, but it may have some holes. So, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Members and Representative Abler, you had a very tough job when you were chair of this committee, and it's a little easier this year. Not real easy, but it's certainly easier than what you had to put up with. So next we have Laura Kramer.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Laura Kramer, and I am the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Dental Association, and I am here on behalf of our 3,500 members. First, I'd like to thank you as the committee for giving us the opportunity to speak. We'd like to thank the Governor and Commissioner Jessen for their recommendation to increase the reimbursement rates for dental services for medical assistance in both fee-for-service and managed care. This is a really great first step. It acknowledges the existing problems in the oral health program today, especially given the budget deficit. However, we do believe that more must be done to provide patient access to dental care across the state, especially as we increase the number of enrollees in the medical assistance program. Today, in many ways, the system is broken. The provider rates haven't been increased for at least 14 years. They are in some way based off of 1989 or 1992 fee schedules. And needless to say, Minnesota ranks among the worst in the country as far as our fee schedule for dentists. And we know that this creates access issues for patients. We feel like we're at a breaking point. Many communities are losing their dentists. There are many clinics closing, which leaves patients with nowhere to go. Take, for example, parts of southeastern Minnesota. At least three clinics come to mind that have closed over the last year. So we have patients from places like Faribault going to Rochester just to try and see their dentist. We also know that young dentists that are coming out of school with significant debt can't get banks to loan them money to open a practice in areas where they would be seeing a significant medical assistance population because the rates are so low. These rates typically only cover about 50% of a dentist's costs. As I mentioned, we add to that about 145,000 newly covered patients on medical assistance, and we're adding people to an already broken system. We really need to see these rates increase, but we do need to see them more than the allocated 5%. We urge the department and the legislature to consider incorporating savings from dental-related ER visits and putting money into delivering care at the right time and the right place. In addition, we should take a look at the PMAP outcomes, holding them accountable regarding dental access. For example, how many of those patients really are getting accessible dental care on a regular basis? We also know that significant improvements in the rates have shown in other states that there has been a significant increase in access as well. I'd also like to call your attention to the Legislative Auditor's Report that will be being released in the first week of March. This report is specific to the dental reimbursement rates, their impact on the provider network, and access to care. With that, we look forward to working with you as we move forward at this significant issue. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Kramer, could you get me, on like a half a page, our reimbursement rates for dentists in this state versus the states around us and the national rates?
Yeah, we'd be happy to.
Thank you. Okay, next is Mary Krenke from the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Good
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krenke. I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We represent 144 hospitals and healthcare systems across the state. Like many organizations here today, we like many of the provisions in the Governor's Health and Human Services budget. We do have a couple of concerns that I'd like to bring to your attention. First and foremost, though, I'd like to say we are very strongly supporting the Governor's recommendations to expand our Medicaid eligibility under the ACA. And I know you all have heard the testimony from Representative Huntley's bill, House File 5, which deals with the population below 138% of the federal poverty guidelines. That was in House File 1. That's coverage for low-income adults without minor children. The bill includes that portion of the expansion, and the governor's budget also includes the coverage for children up to 275% of the federal poverty guidelines. So the governor's budget proposal has both components of that Medicaid expansion. Representative Huntley's bill dealt with one portion of that, I believe. We're supporting, obviously, both portions. The second item I would like to mention is the MERC program. And I know many of you remember the MERC discussions from previous years. The governor's budget includes $12.8 million for the MERC program. This is money that is used to train our next generation of physicians, advanced practice registered nurses, pharmacists, and dentists. And we just heard about the dental shortage a few minutes ago here. I would like to read one statistic that I think is kind of interesting on the MERC program. According to the Association of American Medical Colleges, about half of the 200 medical students who graduated from the University of Minnesota last year completed their residencies here in Minnesota. 72% of that number stayed in Minnesota. So the translation for us is if we can get our medical students into residency programs, they like it here. But we've got to get them into residency programs first. We're not a magnet. You know, go outside on a day like today or last week. We're not drawing people into Minnesota. But if we can get these residency spots here, they find they actually like it here. But we've got to get them into the residency spots first. So we're very pleased with this restoration of funding. Like other provider groups, we are pleased to see small but important restoration in some of the budget cuts that have been made. Inpatient hospital rates have a 2% increase in the governor's budget proposal, and outpatient services have a 5% rate like the other provider groups. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that hospital inpatient rates right now are at 2002 costs minus 26%. 2% won't go a long way, but it's a help and a step in the right direction. I have two concerns that I would like to mention. One program that I know you all probably have not heard a lot about is the 340B drug program. And this is a program that was a federal program to help hospitals that purchase a large number of pharmaceuticals for primarily Medicaid patients. And it was expanded under the ACA to also include critical access hospitals and children's hospitals. And the rationale for that was that those hospitals have a lot of government patients, either Medicare or children on Medicaid. And the governor's budget proposal has savings from that 340B program. And it was a program that was intended to help hospitals that purchase a lot of drugs. And so we're not quite sure how this proposed cut would work. And so we just want to bring that to your attention. I believe somebody, a pharmacist from Hennepin County Medical Center, who knows far more about this than I do, I believe they're going to be testifying on this issue as well. But I just wanted to tell you we have some concerns about it. And the last issue that I wanted to mention is the managed care savings that are in the bill. In the governor's budget. There's $59 million in savings attributed to further cuts or savings in the PMAP program. And I don't want to say we're opposed to that, but I think it's important to ask, how will that $59 million come about? Is it through efficiencies at the health plans? Is it from their margins? Or will those cuts merely be passed on to providers? And I know Representative Lieberman has talked about this a number of times. How do we look at this PMAP program? We're not saying it's bad to continue moving forward with this contracting with the managed care plans, but I just wanted to ask about the savings that are in the governor's budget proposal. And the last item, Mr. Chairman, it is not in the governor's DHS budget proposal, but I just want to go on record saying the Hospital Association strongly supports the cigarette tax increase that the governor has proposed, and we believe there'll be other bills on that issue as well. So, thank you.
I would like to set up a private meeting with a bunch of groups to talk about the 340B problem so that I really understand that issue, and we'll be setting that up.
Great.
And then we'll have a public hearing on it.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Jody Harpstead?
Good morning, Chairman Huntley, members of the committee. I'm Jody Harpstead, CEO of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, serving our neighbors in all 87 counties of the state of Minnesota, and now in our 148th year of service to the people of Minnesota. It is my deep personal conviction that no young person in Minnesota should have to sleep under a bridge, ever, or in the woods outside Brainerd, or in a car in the Walmart parking lot in Mankato. The youth who show up in the youth services community in Minnesota have been abused and neglected by their parents and let down and let go by the foster care system. They need support while they finish growing up and get a foothold in the adult community. In 2006, when the Minnesota legislature passed the Homeless Youth Act, the youth community asked for $8 million in funding to make it work. It remains in the governor's budget today at $238,000. Youth services are some of the smallest investment, highest return services in Lutheran Social Services, 23 lines of service, and the least well supported by government. We're talking about John, who worked his way through our Renaissance Transitional Living Service in Duluth, started a career in sales, and is effectively parenting his little boy, Jack. Youth like Tony and Sarah, who I met in Mankato this year, who have received nothing from us but a drop-in center, counselors to talk to as they set goals for their lives, and an occasional free pizza. Tony and Sarah are both pulling down 4.0 grade point averages in college and are on their way to productive adult lives. We're in a redesign partnership with Catholic Charities, the Wilder Foundation, the Metro Youth Services Redesign Council, Youth Moving Forward, and the Homes for All Coalition to ask that Minnesota finally put $8 million into the Homeless Youth Act to fund our innovative ideas to get the 2,500 homeless youth in Minnesota off the street. The youth provider community in Minnesota gets results. Help us to help our youth and to create new Minnesota taxpayers. 2 years ago, we introduced an innovative design for people with disabilities in Minnesota called My Life, My Choices, which would allow people with disabilities to design their own lives at lower cost to taxpayers. We've worked closely with Commissioner Jessen and her office to incorporate our design into their Reform 2020 proposal. DHS will introduce the changes necessary to allow us to implement Reform 2020 and My Life, My Choices, and we're eager to get underway. So when that comes forward, please give the commissioner whatever she wants. It's all good stuff. On the other hand, there's the 1.67% cut to our current services for people with disabilities left over from the last budget session. Steve Larson from the ARC of Minnesota mentioned this earlier. We hope that a new biennium, a new forecast, and a new legislature will rethink that one. What sounds like a tiny amount would cut over $300,000 out of LSS's services in just 6 months, for us, a major concern. LSS, Courage Center, and Fairview Health Services sponsored a design session 2 weeks ago to imagine ways to integrate social service and healthcare. We need to maintain our capacity to go for the transformation we're planning together and not stop to deal with an enormous loss. We've already begun to move 50 of the 1,400 people LSS supports into host homes and technology-assisted living. Cutting funding for traditional services just causes damage, not incentives to innovate. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I'd be interested in actually having a hearing on public hearing on the homeless youth. I'll bring in all the groups that are interested in this. And then the.
Thank you very much.
The Human Services 2020 report on
great.
This.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Cisa Keller. in my office yesterday.
Yes, I was. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Cisa Keller for the record. I'm the Government Relations Committee Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association. The Minnesota Child Care Association is an organization of almost 250 privately owned and operated licensed child care programs throughout Minnesota. I'm here today to express our support of the investments in the child care assistance program that were proposed by Governor Dayton in his budget. The goal of these targeted investments is to align the child care assistance program with current research that demonstrates that access to high quality care and education has huge benefits for working families, young children, and all of Minnesota. Wilder Research recently released a report that showing for every child that starts kindergarten not ready, it will cost the state on average $56,000 over the lifetime of that child. And with 50% of our children not starting kindergarten ready, that equates to a loss of $860 million every year going forward if we do nothing. The proposed investments also begin to address the huge gap between the true cost of high-quality child care and what the current reimbursement rate structure is. This investment will make significant differences in providing true access to Minnesota's youngest children to high-quality child care and will result in school readiness outcomes. We look forward to talking to the committee more and working with you through session at looking at this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Jennifer Sorensen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Jennifer Sorensen, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Home Care Association. I represent over 200 home health agencies within the state of Minnesota, those that are freestanding as well as those that are hospital-based and medically based. I'm here to, one, applaud the governor's attempts and efforts towards reform and putting things forward in a new face and a new light. And there's a lot of things that we do support within the governor's budget, one being the access to increased access to health care through the Affordable Care Act. We also are very happy to see Reform 2020 and some of the efforts with the community-based services programming that are there. We also have some issues with that, which I will touch on in just a second. The other one is increased funding for the mental health services. We believe that that is a very important community-based service, and we very much appreciate the efforts in that area. And then we also are very excited for some of the program integrity measures that the governor has put forth. With all of that, lots of reform, lots of change, we have some concerns. We, as you know, there is not written currently a COLA increase into the governor's biennium budget. This is a major concern for all of us providers, and I think you've heard the themes over the yesterday and today. There were some great efforts that were done in the last legislative cycle to potentially push some of those off, and we appreciated those efforts from you all. But we are facing kind of a triple whammy this year, one being the 1.67% cut, also the payment shift that will happen July 1. We will not receive payments through that last month of the biennium budget, which will be a huge concern with home care agencies barely being able to perform the way it is with the current rates that we have, which we've been cut increasingly since 2008 with no increases or paybacks or buybacks to our system. We are concerned about the ability to continue to provide high quality care in communities. What I can tell you is we are having home health agencies close in some of these rural communities. Access will become an issue at some point, and I believe that it's now that we address some of those concerns because we have more and more people wanting to age at home. One of the other pieces that is somewhat of a concern through the Affordable Care Act is the employer mandate. One of the pieces with that is that providing that health care. As you know, because we haven't received the rate increases, we are looking at issues of not being able to pay providers livable wages, which in turn we're not able to provide the coverage that they deserve for the work that they do. We have, you know, agencies having to make choices, business choices that do not allow for high quality care. You've heard testimony about quality and insurance in regards to how services are delivered, especially in people's homes. And we really do support that standard, and we really want that bar set high. But we also have to, there is a a price tag to that, unfortunately. And we're hopeful that we can work with you and the Department of Human Services, as well as the Health Department, through some of the changes and the reforms that are going to you will be seeing. I empathize with the process that you all have to go through this year. While very intriguing and exciting, and as the chairman mentioned, not as difficult as in years past, but yet still challenging in itself to determine what priorities you will push forward. I thank you for your time, and I would love to meet with any of you if you have any concerns.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, and next is Lynn Megan.
Good morning, Chair Huntley and committee members. I am Lynn Megan, the president of TSE Incorporated, a day training habilitation organization located in Ramsey County. We serve approximately 325 individuals with employment and training support services. This morning, I'm speaking on behalf of MOHR, M-O-H-R, a newly formed entity, which is a merged organization of a macro, so rehab organizations from throughout Minnesota, and the former MHC, Minnesota Habilitation Coalition. MOHR is the Minnesota Organization of Habilitation and Rehabilitation. We're comprised of 49 organizations throughout the state providing primarily employment services to thousands of Minnesotans with disabilities. Today I'd like to address several points and observations which are included in Governor Dayton's proposed budget. Firstly, we are amazed and frankly frustrated that our organizations were not recommended for a rate increase in this budget. It's been several years since our direct support professional staff have been recognized for their hard work with a statewide cost of living increase. In fact, our last time was 2009. In the past several budget cycles, services for people with disabilities have experienced at least a 3.58% cut and reduction in our rates of service. Other private and public sector employees have enjoyed continued cost of living pay adjustments. We do not dispute the validity of their adjustments. We're asking for equity through the system. Our hardworking direct support professional workforces desperately need a raise, and providers need a COLA this session to be able to need that happen. As you've heard from various people, the organizations that MOHR represents are representative of the additional rate cut of 1.67% in July of this year, as well as the delayed June payment. The governor's budget fails to address this matter entirely, and we ask you to work with us to take steps to reverse that plan. MOHR members have also learned that regarding increases in licensing fees, beginning with the promulgation of our Department of Human Services Rule 245D. As an example, our TSE license rates have been approximately $6,000 a year for the 325 people that we represent. The proposed licensing rate increases would increase our license fees to $20,000, so an increase of $14,000. And in fact, we don't have a licensor who comes to our site because we choose to be CARF accredited. So we have no on-site representation, people in that review process from the licensure. So again, we have an increase to our expenses with no increase to our rates. While we're concerned and alarmed by the omissions in the governor's budget, we are hopeful. We're intentional and supportive of changes that will move the system in a direction to be more responsive to the people that we serve. We are encouraged by the governor's support for the Reform 2020 innovations. We especially support provisions to put people served in a position to make their own choices and take control of their funding for community-directed community supports. MOHR member agencies are also committed to work collaboratively with DHS in support of improving quality outcomes for people. We encourage your committee to work closely with us in implementation of MIN choices, provider enrollment, and rate setting methodology. We want to continue to partner with the legislature and with DHS to create innovative solutions that will be successful and drive quality services for people. But again, we need relief, we need equity, and we need help from this committee to get this right, because we are not getting that consideration in the governor's proposed budget. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Next is Judith Rumfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're trying to keep it down to 3 minutes.
Yes, and I'm cutting my presentation. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Judith Brumfield. I'm the Health and Human Services Director in Scott County, but I'm here today representing the Minnesota County Association, the Association of Minnesota Social Service Administrators, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. We recognize the budgetary challenges that this legislature faces, and we're interested in proposals that actually maximize services within the existing resources. We believe that this can best be accomplished by utilizing technology to create efficiencies, by administrative simplification, and by aligning funding with outcomes. We also believe that additional funding should be directed toward those programs that provide preventative services that lead to future cost avoidance. The governor's proposed a significant investment in technology, and I believe as committee members you would be stunned to see the DOS-based system that our county human services staff have to use in order to determine eligibility for the state programs. The rest of us started living in a window-based environment in the 1990s. This group still has a pre-1990s environment. The county's greatest concern with the governor's budget is the implementation of two new cost shifts to counties. From the state, the governor's budget proposes a statewide impact of $8.14 million per biennium from the state to the general fund to county property taxes. Based on cost shifts in the previous years, counties are currently responsible for a percentage of costs to both Anoka Regional Treatment Center and the Minnesota Security Hospital. The county cost share in the governor's budget would increase from 50% to 75% for the Anoka Regional Treatment Center and from 10% to 50% at the St. Peter Security Hospital. In the 2013 rates, this would mean an increase of $255 per day for a patient at Anoka or $221 per day from a patient in St. Peter. The cost shares are applied to those who have been deemed ready for community placement, but that there is no resource in the community for them. Counties are committed to working with the department to find a solution. We believe that people ready for community settings should be there, but we believe that this cost shift is not the correct way to go about making that happen. Counties also support the governor's proposal to fund the infrastructure of the new outcome-based county human services system. I personally spent the last 3.5 years working with the Performance Steering Committee to design that system. The small appropriation of $750,000 per year will move us forward with 3 years of cooperative work on the part of the department, counties, and advocate groups focused on holding counties accountable for the outcomes and responsible for their human services programs while at the same time removing prescriptive processes. In the area of administrative simplification, there are multiple components, and it's important that these be resourced so that valuable county staff can be dedicated to services directly to the citizens in need. An example of that is legislation that you passed in 2011, Chapter 9, Article 9, that required the department and counties to provide recommendations by January of this year to align program policy and procedures across public assistance programs. Implementing this is critical to being able to actually do a technology simplification process We are concerned that this is not included in the governor's budget and believe it's important that this be resourced in order to move us ahead with technology improvements. Finally, the governor's budget does have a number of new initiatives that MACSA and the county support. Briefly, those are the North Star Care for Children Initiative, the Parent Support Outreach Program, the expansion of school-length mental health grants, the funding to ensure child care for young mothers to complete high school, and the implementation or investments in family home visiting programs. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into any detail on these programs, but I do believe that the voices of the people served by the programs that are provided on the handout that you received demonstrate the importance of these programs to the people we serve. In summary, the governor's budget has a balanced approach to addressing critical current needs while at the same time investing in programs to reduce future public costs. Counties support this governor's budget in terms of the Health and Human Services with some qualifications and would look forward to working with you as you begin to actually have hearings on the budget. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Brunfeld, I just have to say a personal thank you to you for devoting more time than probably any other county person in working with DHS on performance standards for counties. And I know that probably was a made your life a lot more complicated. But I'd really be interested in hearing, and I'm sure the rest of the committee would, your ideas on how we can not just punish counties who aren't able to discharge people from St. Peter or Anoka because we have inadequate capacity, but also how we can contribute to the solution, because I know part of the problem is there's no place to discharge them to. We have a moratorium on, you know, corporate foster. I mean, our ability to develop additional community services is really handcuffed, and if the organizations you represent have some ideas on how to loosen that up, I would be very interested, and I think the rest of us would be, because just putting a financial penalty without a solution in terms of service development just doesn't seem like progress.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think certainly there will be further discussion, and we do have some ideas, but very briefly, we do believe the department is interested in developing additional resources within the community and is actually funding that. Our concern is that the penalty comes before anything is really available in the community. So we look forward to and have had discussions with the department about the need to really examine within the community the difficulty with finding placements, because these are people with that may not need a hospital setting, but they definitely are not at a point in their lives to fit into any of the community settings we have. For example, a level 3 sex offender who is coming into the community trying to find an appropriate placement. One of the department staff talked about investing about $500,000 in developing a resource for one person. It's extremely costly. It's going to take time to develop those resources within the community. Counties would like to work with the department in doing that, but to begin a fiscal penalty when indeed those resources aren't available doesn't necessarily serve the population well.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And next is Stephen Adair. And I want to remind folks that we have 1/2 hour left. So if you keep it down to 3 minutes, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Adair. My current profession is a family adult foster care provider for 3 developmentally disabled adults for the past 11 years. Formerly, I was a county social worker licensing adult foster care homes for over 12 years in Aiken County, Wright County, and Hampton County. Today, I wish to speak to you in regards to the payment rates to family adult foster care providers versus corporate adult foster care providers and the licensing fees for the 245D license. The 245D rule that starts January 1st, 2014 requires both corporate adult foster care and family adult foster care do exactly the same requirements for taking care of various waiver handicapped clients. The only difference, as defined in Rule 245D, is that the family provider is where the license holder lives in the home and is the primary caregiver. When it comes to payment for those exact same services provided by the very slightly different providers, the corporate providers have over 46 different line items that they can bill for their services, when family providers could only bill for 10 items to DHS. Many services are required by the 245D rule that have no way for family providers to bill for. We are required to do 30 hours of orientation training before any person has unsupervised time with a client. We must also get 40 hours of training each year. The payment system allows for a way for corporates to bill for this and no compensation at all for family adult foster care to bill. The paperwork requirements are exactly the same for both corporate and family homes. That paperwork must be completed by a professional with a college degree. The family providers must hire this individual, but they have no way to pay for it in the payment part of the rule. In regards to the professional equipment and assistance to complete administrative tasks, the corporates are allowed a 15% add-on per client, while family homes are allowed only 3% add-on to do the exact same rule requirements. How is this fair? What court in the land would not side with the family providers in a major lawsuit if this is allowed to become law without changes? In the case of overnight pay, corporates are paid $9 an hour for a sleep staff, while families are paid $203 an hour. DHS says is because family providers are already in the house. But what about if we need a break from taking care of clients 7 days a week, 365 days a year? Where do we find someone to cover the night shifts for $2.03 an hour? Would any of you care to come to work for me for that? Would you let your kid work for that? Not a chance. There's no provision for any respite care or vacation, or if we get sick and must pay outside staff to cover us. We must also pay that staff for 30 hours of orientation and 40 hours training a year. We must also pay $20 for every background check for staff. Where in the payment system do we bill that back to the state? Nowhere. The corporates have ways to bill for it. These requirements being added on to family providers all add up to an extreme amount of money for families, with no ways for the providers to bill it back to the state. These costs have to be paid for. We cannot have unfunded mandates at this level. When DHS was required by the federal government to increase the level of supervision and requirements for all waiver providers were increased, the federal government mandated that all providers have the exact same requirements, and the federal government said the payment was to be the same from one end of the state to the other. The federal government pointed out the huge differences in pay across the state and that Minnesota was required to fix this. These rules continue to make it worse.
Mr. Ader, could you wrap it up?
Sure. The last item that I just found out this week was our licensing fee was changed to $1,125 per home plus $84 per client. Corporates, if you have 400 homes, you pay a base fee of $1,125 per home. I mean, for the whole license for the state. A family provider pays $1,125 for their one home. How's that fair? You know, the big corporates should be carrying more of the cost of these licensing fees. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Michael Herenstahl from Hennepin County.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you. I am an administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center. Bruce Thompson is our director of pharmacy, so we'll try to link our two presentations together and get on with our work in the allocated time. Most of you know Hennepin County Medical Center. Just a big overview, of course, is that we have a safety net mission and role, very integral to the education of health professionals as well as the disaster preparedness system here in the metropolitan area. I wanted to emphasize really innovation in what we are doing relative to the care model and developing our system. We do see over 2,500 patients each and every day through our care system, really trying to bring high value and clinical quality to the people we serve. Some of this you've seen in our Hennepin Health ACO project. The rate of cost increases at HCMC is below the rate of inflation. We are very appreciative of the governor's budget proposal around health and human service issues. We think there are a lot of very good investments in the health of Minnesotans, and we are very happy about all of that. There are two areas of concern that we'd like to share with you. One is the funding for the Poison Control Center. It is the ultimate preventive measure that we can take relative to health. We understand and can document $1 spent on poison control saves $11 in health care costs. And that's an area that we no longer have the ability to cross-subsidize, and really we need to find a durable funding source for that poison center as we can move forward. The second area of concern that we have is around the 340B program. Mary Krinke alluded to that earlier, and Bruce is going to give you a little bit more about that this morning. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Bruce Thompson. I'm Director of Health System Pharmacy Services at Hennepin County Medical Center. As Mary alluded, the 340B program is a concern. We've passed out a short note explaining a brief bit about it. The proposal in the governor's budget is to reduce our reimbursement by 32%. That takes away any margin that we had in the past. And also back in 2006, DHS did a survey of pharmacies throughout the state and determined to fill a prescription in a community pharmacy was approximately $10, and that is now 6-7 years ago. The fee added on to it is $3.65. There's two portions of the 340B program: the drugs that we give to outpatients within Hennepin County Medical Center, which those within the clinics are usually injectable products. Our costs to prepare those drugs are anywhere from $15 to $100 to cost for the labor and the technology and the equipment, in addition to the cost of the drug. Our average cost to buy the drug is 39% below wholesale acquisition cost, and the proposal of the governor is minus 44%. On the community side, we dispensed almost 100,000 prescriptions to the Medicaid population last year. Our cost of labor to provide that is almost $1.4 million. And again, we'd have a shortfall with the proposed budget through the governor's office. The 340B program is designed to provide three primary areas: reduce prices of pharmaceuticals to patients. Last year, Hennepin County provided $4.7 million of prescriptions to our patients at no charge. We've provided an additional amount of dollars to those that provided a very low cost $4 copay to those prescriptions. The charity program, a family of four with an income of less than $46,000 without insurance, receives these benefits. This covers both children, adults, those with special needs. Expanded services is another specific area of the 340B program. Over the past 4 or 5 years, we've expanded a number of pharmacy programs with medication therapy management in unique areas that have helped reduce admissions and hospitalizations by over 35%, and DHS and Minnesota has been a benefit by reducing those hospitalizations. We've improved access by expanding pharmacies, expanding hours, and plan to open additional pharmacies in other areas of the county to make the pharmaceutical needs more accessible to our patients. We really are looking forward to working with DHS to come up with a proposal that would be more amenable to both the county, or to the state and to the 340B entities. In the past, we have shared the savings. Our discount compared to the rest of the community pharmacies have been approximately double. So DHS has, but now they're looking to take away more than any of the cost savings that we would have seen. And we unfortunately would have to reduce services that may increase overall health care costs.
Mr. Chair, we certainly would look forward to the chance to talk with you in detail about this, as you suggested earlier.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And next we have Dan Kitzberger and Elizabeth Olson from Duluth. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and I just have a quick visual representation for you as it relates to some of the various housing and homelessness expenditures that we do in the state of Minnesota. The first is, and I'll just remind folks, this represents a single fiscal year. So the first is the home mortgage interest deduction. It's about $330 million a year. That's what we give for homeowners to deduct their home mortgage interest. The second canister, this is $28 million. This represents things like housing with services, prevention, and rental assistance that we provide for families at risk of losing their housing or experiencing homelessness. This represents the amount of money we spend on shelter. This is $350,000 a year. I'm sorry, I neglected to mention the dollar amount. This is $28 million a year. This is $350,000 a year. Now, what the governor's budget proposes is to give every homeowner a $500 property tax rebate. So this is a little over $700 million a year because you're a homeowner in the state of Minnesota. And this represents $1.5 million for a rental assistance program in the Minnesota housing budget. For the programs, for the homeless service programs in the DHS budget, he recommends that the funding levels remain flat. Now, as a homeowner, I can tell you personally, and like many of you, I appreciate some property tax relief. But as a Minnesotan, I think we need to do better for people at risk of losing their housing or experiencing homelessness. And as Liz will tell you, keeping these funding levels flat doesn't reflect the rising need. So thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Olson, and I'm the Director of Congregational Outreach at Churches United and Ministry in Duluth. CHUM serves both single adults and families who are experiencing homelessness. We urge this committee to invest in housing, homeless prevention, and supportive services. For many people we serve, housing is health care. Wayne was truly a special man who got involved with CHUM during the Save the GAMC campaign. Wayne's early years were filled with transition. As an adult, he spent years in homelessness and struggling with addiction. He had a fragile life. This all turned around when he was able to move into San Marco housing and receive supportive services. His health improved and his addiction subsided. He became involved in the community to help others have a better chance at life. Wayne came with us to the Capitol several times, meeting with Representative Huntley and others from Duluth. He became part of the CHUM family. Wayne recently died, but I know he had a better quality of life in those final years because of supportive housing. When it comes to supportive services, there is a high return on investment. We can spend a little on housing and case management, or we can spend a lot on emergency room care, jail, detox, and shelters. I'd love to end this on a positive note, but frankly, times are tough in Duluth. Current levels of homelessness in St. Louis County are higher now than at any time in the last 5 years. We're serving a record number of homeless families and their children at CHUM. Families are the new face of homelessness. We're seeing younger and younger children in our shelters.
they're just little peanuts. Families are staying with us longer too, 45 days on average, up from 30. Local nonprofits can meet immediate needs, but we cannot remove the big barriers by ourselves. Jobs don't pay enough, housing is too expensive. This is where you come in. You have the opportunity to make a concrete difference in the lives of Minnesotans. Please invest in cost-effective and dignified programs in the Health and Human Services budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and how's the weather? Yeah. Next is Michael Scandrett.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net, and I'll shorten my testimony. There are a couple of handouts coming around that tell more about the Safety Net Coalition and its members and about the recommendations that we have. Also, because, of course, there's not language out yet and there's not a lot of detail yet, I'll try to focus more on some general principles and then would look forward to working with the committee later on to bring in more specific ideas. The Safety Net Coalition is consists of nonprofit healthcare organizations whose mission is serving the patients and communities who have the greatest health disparities currently. They're low-income, diverse, face a lot of socioeconomic barriers. So these are providers who specialize in serving the people who have the greatest needs. And often generally, those who have the greatest needs also need a lot of additional services beyond just a clinic visit. They will often need interpreters if they don't speak the language. They may need transportation if they don't have a form of transportation. They may have a lot of other things going on in their lives that complicate their medical conditions. So the safety net providers, by choosing to serve the people with the greatest needs, also end up having the greatest resource needs in order to meet those needs. It's more expensive and complex to help a person with a lot of problems become healthy and access their treatment than it is someone that doesn't have a lot of those same problems. And so the principle that we're recommending and would want to be working with you on is really that resources in healthcare should be focused where the needs are the greatest, so that those people who have the greatest needs should receive those additional resources they need to be healthy. And that kind of recognizing the additional time and services that are necessary to help those people who are experiencing the greatest disparities today. One thing that I also wanted to emphasize, too, is with the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion, one would think that everything's going to be rosy for the safety net providers, but based on Massachusetts' experience with their program and what we are anticipating, there's risk that the safety net providers will end up with a higher concentration of the remaining uninsured, which is estimated to be over 200,000 people, and also a higher concentration of Medicaid and public program patients that don't pay very well. So there's a risk that even though these are really important expansions of coverage, there's a risk that the safety net providers would may be even worse off than before if they're getting a higher volume of patients who are both uninsured or low-income patients. And losing money on Medicaid patients, you can't make it up on volume by seeing more patients. So just to kind of wrap things up, knowing that your time is limited, what we would like to suggest is to continue and expand the existing policy in the state budget of providing enhanced critical access payments for those types of providers who have very high concentrations of uninsured and Medicaid and low-income patients that are experiencing those higher resource needs and serving them. This is already, to some extent, in some budget provisions, but there are some gaps in that. And also, we think the amounts that are being paid are inadequate, really, to cover those additional costs that safety net providers incur in serving those populations. So probably just to end it there with that principle of targeting for where the needs are the greatest and critical access payments and funding to support the safety net system that so it can continue to serve those with the greatest needs, and look forward to working with the committee on the details in both the language and the budget items.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Next is Glenn Nelson, Blue Cross Blue Shield, who gave up talking yesterday. We've only got 10 minutes left, so
I'll be very brief. Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nelson from Blue Cross Blue Shield in Minnesota, and I'm here to voice our strong support for the governor's proposal to increase the tobacco tax. Blue Cross has long been committed to reducing tobacco use in Minnesota. In 2010, we released a report, Cost of Smoking in Minnesota, and that report, it indicated that Minnesota is spending approximately $3 billion a year excess in health care costs related to smoking. We also know that one of the most effective tools to reduce tobacco use is to significantly increase the cost of tobacco. In fact, it is the single most effective way to stop kids from starting. Therefore, we encourage you to support the governor's proposal as a starting point and actually increase it up to $1.50 instead of the 94 cents that's in the proposal to have the most significant impact in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Sue Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, Sue Abderholden.
We're going to have, just a minute, Tara Hardy is after. She's not on the agenda, but... Sean Tara. Okay, well. Oh. Yeah, Sean Tara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sue Abderholden with NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I appreciate the opportunity this morning. First, we're very thankful that the governor's budget increases by 50% and then 100% the school-linked mental health grants. Minnesota does it the right way. We address the barriers families face, such as transportation, time, and insurance, by providing grants to the mental health providers to treat children and youth in the schools. Providers can bill public and private insurance to help cover the costs, making it a sustainable model. By using mental health providers and not school employees, we keep a firewall between education and health care records. Since this program started, we've treated over 13,000 kids. Half of them have never received services before, and half of them had a serious mental illness. If you haven't heard how much NAMI likes this program, then you haven't been listening. We are also supportive of adding family psychoeducation and care coordination to the MA benefit set. Families need help understanding their child's illness and how to help them. Some of the children have very complex illnesses, and care coordination can help keep their child safe and well. Expansion of crisis services is also important. However, we would want to make sure that the teams have specialized training on working with families of children. After seeing numerous ARMS providers close, we're glad to see this issue will be addressed. There has been some talk in the press about the need for more hospital beds, but what we really need are more viable community services. And losing ARMS providers doesn't help. We are, however, concerned that in order to pay for it, funding for community support programs and the Adult Mental Health Initiative would be reduced. We are concerned with proposals for state-operated services. The devil, of course, is in the details, but why are we establishing state-run transition services instead of contracting with community providers? There appears to be a little mission drift. SOS needs to clearly define what their role is within the mental health system and then stick to it. We obviously strongly support the MA rate increase and the MA expansion. We are concerned about several of the Reform 2020 initiatives. We believe they don't recognize that mental illnesses are different than other disabilities. We're particularly concerned about the program that's targeting young adults with a serious mental illness or young adults exiting foster care. The department is not proposing to use an evidence-based practice, but instead will be sending a letter and encouraging people to call in order to obtain employment, and I don't think that works very well with 21-year-olds. Finally, let me say that it's not a secret to anyone in this room that we have a fragile, underfunded mental health system for both children and adults. While we appreciate what is in here, there is a lot that isn't in the budget, including funding for supportive housing, IPS employment, intensive treatment for people experiencing their first psychotic episode, creating more intermediate levels of residential treatment, respite care, workforce development, and more. You know, we're kind of in a conundrum because private insurance, you know, doesn't have to pay for mental health services. Medicaid doesn't pay for Anoka or St. Peter. Medicare also discriminates. We have the county saying, although we have the Adult Mental Health and Children's Mental Health Act, saying, well, we're not really responsible for developing services. We have the state, even though they're the mental health authority, saying, well, we're going to make the counties do it. And so, frankly, in some ways, I'm not surprised that, you know, I would receive calls from, say, a dad whose son is being discharged from a hospital to a homeless shelter, even though he's under commitment, or talking to a mom whose teenager desperately needs residential treatment and yet is turned down by a county, or a wife whose husband has bipolar disorder and substance use disorder, and he's being bounced from a CD treatment to a mental health treatment facility and repeatedly back and forth and never going into an integrated dual diagnosis treatment. So in some ways, no one is responsible, so nothing is being developed, and we're frankly stuck then. So I want to urge you to continue to work with us to eliminate the major holes and barriers in the mental health system, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next is Shantara Hardy, who's probably come the shortest distance. Did you walk or drive?
I drove. I have on my non-Minnesota shoes today. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shantara Hardy, and I'm the Government Relations Manager at Health Partners. I thank you for the opportunity to testify on the governor's budget. Because Health Partners plays the role of both payer and provider of care, we have a unique perspective on the budget. I'm going to be brief because my colleagues from the Hospital Association and HCMC touched on all the key areas that impact us with supporting MA expansion, the Merck funding, 340B, the tobacco tax and SHIP. But I do want to just take a minute to talk about emergency medical assistance, which was not highlighted. We are appreciative of the governor, including the $5.3 million for the cancer care and the dialysis care. However, we really believe that there needs to be a comprehensive strategy for this population. Our experience at Regions, there are a number of patients that are coming into the emergency room that are chronically ill, and they don't qualify in the area of cancer and dialysis, and we're having problems with discharge. There's nowhere for them to go because they don't have coverage. And so we have a couple patients in our house right now that are 100 days past discharge, and they are creeping up to $1 million for individual patients. And so I'm very hopeful that we can work with you and the department to figure out a strategy for this population and also for the 200,000 that will be needing care after 2014 and the reforms that go into effect. And so we really want to make sure that this is a priority. I know it's a hard discussion with respect to the population, but from a safety net perspective and having charity care at $20 million a year, we just can't afford to have patients just in our trauma beds when they need to be out getting the care that they need in the community. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And we're going to skip one here for a minute and go to Lee Lewis. And again, we're basically out of time, so if you can really keep this summarize your whole thing, I would appreciate it.
If I could do it virtually, I would. Just thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lee Lewis. I'm the Executive Director of Clare Housing, which is the largest provider of housing to people with HIV and AIDS in the state of Minnesota. We have three different programs. We have permanent supportive housing. We house about 72 people in two different sites. We have adult foster care programs, and we also have scattered site housing for individuals and families who have HIV and have been homeless for a year or more. We serve marginalized folks, poor individuals. Virtually no one that we house makes more than 30% of the area median income. Most of the individuals are dually diagnosed with neurological problems due to HIV, dementia, neuropathy, as well as heart conditions, diabetes, mental illness, and chemical dependency. I appreciate the opportunity to respond or react to the governor's budget. I will address four different things. First of all, and it's been raised here before, the lack of an increase in home and community-based waivers services. We've experienced over the last 5 years a decrease in those rates while the cost of living has gone up about 9%. That's hard to manage. We've managed it through putting in technology, overnight technology in some of our homes, in changing the staffing ratios, and putting in a sleep overnight care. But we can't do much more. In addition to that, we were one of the organizations that was hit very hard by the 10% targeted reduction in caddy rates 2 years ago. 60% of the people that we serve were hit with that rate. That's a 6% decrease in our rates, $120,000 a year, due entirely to what I think and many agree was a bad assessment system for identifying people who were low need. But people that we serve were hit with that. So I would encourage an increase in the caddy rates. Secondly, I would strongly support an increase in long-term homeless supportive services. We rely heavily on caddy at this point, as well as GRH in terms of state funding. We have a lot of federal funding. But support services from DHS are critical to continuing to do our work. The third issue that I would like to address is the rescinding the waiver reduction of 1.67%. I won't go into that. It's been addressed by several people before me. And then finally, I will, last legislative session, the 10% rollback on low needs folks in congregate settings was addressed. However, we are still waiting to see that. It was contingent on a waiver that has not been received from the federal government. So we're still absorbing that $120,000 a year cut. I would certainly encourage looking at rescinding that legislation. Thank you very much for your time, and good luck in your deliberations.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. And next is Jonathan Watson. And Jonathan, if you could really keep it short, maybe a minute, because you can come into my office practically any time.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Director of Public Policy with the Federally Qualified Health Centers, the Association of Community Health Centers. I just have 3 points I'll make in less than a minute. First and foremost, we support a Medicaid expansion in the governor's budget. We serve 70,000 uninsured folks. Nearly 70% of our patients have incomes below 100% of poverty. Clearly, they're going to benefit from expansion of the Medicaid program, and we can begin to eliminate health care disparities that exist in the state. Second point, not that I like to attend meetings, but I'd also like to get in on this 340B meeting that you're going to have. FQHCs are also 340B providers and will be affected by that. And the third and last point is currently under Medicaid policy reimbursement policy, for an encounter at an FQHC, a medical encounter that occurs, if there's a subsequent mental health encounter that same day, we do not receive reimbursement for that second encounter. We have that one-stop shop model where all services are under one roof at an FQHC. So we'd be looking to change that policy because right now we're basically treating that as uncompensated care. And in some situations, which we do very, very infrequently, the patient has to come back the next day, and that's not good for patient continuity of care. So those are my 3 points. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know, your last point there is exactly what's wrong with our health care system. You get punished for doing the right thing, the way we pay. And we'll see if we can work on that one.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have two folks from Crossroads Care Center. And again, if you keep it relatively brief, we're way over time right now. It's not your fault. I apologize for the fact that we had certainly had a how many today? A lot.
Thank you for having me this morning. My name is Shauna Pham, and I have worked for Crossroads Care Center for 6 years. I am a CNA, which is Certified Nursing Assistant, and a TMA, which is a Trained Medical Assistant. The lack of money from poor wages has drastically affected my lifestyle as a single mother of two young girls. The wages are so low that I cannot afford to obtain medical insurance. The starting wage is $962, and after 6 years, now I make $1035. With poor wages, staffing is low, and often new staff find the work physically and mentally too hard on them, and that cannot justify working under these conditions for such low wages. We get them trained in, and then they quit. Therefore, I often end up working short-staffed, technically going to work, doing the work of two individuals and barely getting paid enough for one. I am often physically and mentally exhausted and many times cannot attend to my daughter's needs because I cannot afford to miss work. I work approximately 96 or more hours in a two-week pay period just to make ends meet at my household. When I become ill, which is a valid possible because of working too hard or long hours under such circumstances, my daughters again suffer the loss of my income with their daily material needs being unmet. The whole issue could be remedied by a simple measure of increased wages. I like my work, I truly enjoy working with elderly, which is why I have continued to work in this field. With the population of nursing homes residents increasing as the baby boomers age, we as a state need to look at the future of caring for them in an adequate and appropriate manner. This has to start with staffing properly in our nursing homes, which has everything to do with providing them with a decent wage. Please hear what I am saying. This issue will only become worse if you do not intervene with a change that affords us health care workers as a decent wage as quickly as possible. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Next, Ms. Tillman.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Tillman. I also work for Crossroads Care Center. I've been employed in health care since I was in high school. I love my work and have advanced from a CNA to a TMA recently. This advancement has afforded me a tiny raise, but as a single mother in this field, I am still greatly underpaid and struggle to make ends meet every month. I cannot afford health insurance for myself or my two school-aged daughters. When I am ill, there is no one to compensate for my lost wages, let alone to pay my medical bills, and with them being so low in the first place, I fall back before I can ever get ahead. I work hard to provide excellent care for the residents at a sacrifice to my own personal life many times. I am not ashamed to come before you today in representing the facts that I, as a healthcare worker in the nursing home area, I do not get adequate pay, not just for my work, but to survive financially in this day. I deserve better, and so do our residents. They deserve adequate staffing to assure that when they need to be toileted, they will be toileted. When they need to be assisted with feeding, that there will be someone there to help feed them. Currently, we have a couple of volunteers from the community who come in and assist with feeding residents. I do the work that many would never think of doing, yet someone has to do it, this work for the elderly to survive in this society. Somewhere along the way, we have to find a way to balance meeting the residents' needs adequately and the staff's. I work many 8-hour shifts and then get called back into work because another staff member quit or became ill or could not work. I have worked many 10 to 14 day stretches without time off and still do not have enough money to justify why I continue to work in this field. We as a nation need to get serious about this issue before you yourself or a loved family member need the care I provide and can no longer do when I become physically or mentally unable to continue doing it. Thank you for hearing me out today.
Thank you very much, and I apologize for the delay and overrun, but I know you came a long way to get up here, but thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.